Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
When I was growing up, East Texas might as well have been another planet. I grew up in Phoenix. There was me, my dad, my brother Dan, and the Catholic schools where we were often the only black kids. In my mind, Texas was big hats, rodeos, that show Dallas. And the only thing that connected me to the state was a chunk of land my family owned there. My dad's land was in a tiny town called Gilmer, near Mount Pleasant, where we have a lot of distant relatives. We drove through there once, but I don't remember meeting any relatives. I do recall sleeping in the car and arguing with my brother. After Arizona, I moved to California and then France, about as far as you get from Phoenix. Sometimes my dad would call me and talk about the Texas property, how it would buy a better life for him and my brother, who has a disability, how there might be oil on the land or some kind of rare timber. I was never sure how seriously I should take him, but sometimes I like to fantasize that this could be my retirement. I also like to brag to my French friends about being a Texan landowner. It sounded kind of cool. Years went by. My dad talked less and less about the land, but he never gave up on it. In one email I got from him, he says, "I'm certain of one thing. If that property ever pays off in Texas, we are out of here, to someplace other than Mexico." I have no idea what he meant by Mexico, and I never got a chance to ask. He got cancer, and while sick, a cousin reached out to see whether I could get him to sell some of the land. I tell the cousin how busy I was with kids and work and living abroad. Sort of code for, I really can't be bothered with this right now. Dad died in early 2016, and for the next 4 years, I completely forgot about Texas. But during the pandemic, and after George Floyd was killed, I got to thinking about family. While digging around my closet, I came across a bright red folder called Dad Stuff. I opened it, and I was floored by what I saw.
The data shows that the median white family has 10 times more wealth than the average black family.
One of the drivers of that wealth gap is redlining.
When it comes to understanding financial inequality in this country, economists often point to the absence of African-American generational wealth.
See, the black man gotta fly to get something that the white man could walk to.
It's a trend propelled not just by economic forces, but by white racism and local white political and economic power.
It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty.
Welcome back to The Paycheck. I'm Rebecca Greenfield.
And I'm Jackie Simmons.
In our last two seasons, we looked at all the reasons for and efforts to fix the gender pay gap. This time, we're switching gears. We were starting to think about our third season when the pandemic hit. It quickly became clear there was another economic inequality demanding our attention, the racial wealth gap. I got to talking about it with my colleague, Jackie.
I'd recently moved back to the States after two decades overseas. I came back to a country dealing with its racist past in a way it never had. Black Lives Matter protest, politics, all this on top of a pandemic. That got me thinking about how my own experience with race was shaped by my family's past. And it took me back to Texas and the land. I started asking questions, which led to more questions. And as I went deeper, I wondered how unique our story was. How did Black people build wealth in America? How did they keep or fail to keep it?
That's what Jackie and I will be exploring for the next 8 weeks.
The U.S. is the richest nation in the world and has been for a long time. All told, American households have about $116 trillion in wealth, most of that owned by white people. Black people make up around 13% of the population, but have just 3.8% of the wealth. The U.S. passed civil rights laws meant to remove barriers for Black Americans nearly 60 years ago. Some things have changed a lot, but not the wealth gap.
In real terms, here's what that means. When you count up how much the average American household is worth, including stuff like property, investments, savings, and anything else worth a dime, minus any liabilities like student debt or a mortgage, white households have almost 7 times more than Black households. There are a lot of reasons for that, mostly America's legacy of slavery and racism. And in 2021, that shows up in all kinds of ways that contribute to economic inequality. Black people earn less, pay higher taxes, have more student debt than white people, and so on.
Over time, this has made it harder for Black people to accumulate wealth and pass it on to their children. As much as Americans love the rags-to-riches story, the reality is most people acquire wealth from their parents or their parents' parents. By one measure, 40% of Americans' wealth came from inheritance. It's hard to overstate how important that is. William Darity, who also goes by Sandy, is a professor at Duke University and is one of the nation's leading scholars on race and economics.
If there are certain families that have a greater capacity to provide gifts to the next generation than others, they're also providing that next generation with a greater range of opportunity and a greater likelihood of having a more economically secure future.
For all the reasons we'll talk about this season, white people have had and continue to have huge advantages when it comes to building wealth. Among the 500 richest people in the world that Bloomberg tracks, there are 155 American billionaires, and just one of them, Robert Smith, is Black. Yes, having money means you can buy bigger houses and nicer cars, but it's much more than that. Here's Sandy Darity again.
Wealth can protect you from income losses in emergencies where you might lose a job, where you might be confronted with a catastrophic illness. Wealth provides you with a certain kind of personal insurance.
And having that safety net, it creates different kinds of opportunities and power.
The possibility of moving your family into a high amenity neighborhood, the opportunity of trying to ensure that your children receive a high quality education. It gives you access to the political process. It allows you to leave resources for subsequent generations.
The racial wealth gap tells us a lot about the economy as a whole. Who has security and economic mobility? And this is really important. Whose children get set up for success later on?
So that land my family owned in Texas, my dad hoped it would set us up for success, or at least provide some financial security. And when he inherited the land from his mother, she wanted the same for him and her other children. It didn't quite work out that way.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Anyone dealing with passing down land knows how expensive and messy that process can be, and always has been. But historically, white families and Black families have faced different challenges. And my family's story typifies some of them. The story begins with Will and Barbara Brodus. Barbara was born in 1876. She's my great-great-aunt and was married to Will. They were farmers and had nearly 80 acres in Gilmer, Texas, about 2 hours east of Dallas.
The farm was between the school and their home.
That's Sunny. And like me, she has relatives who were raised by the Brodus.
And they raised peas, corn, beans, okra, English peas, onions, watermelon, cantaloupe. They raised everything they could.
People thought of the Brodus as strict, God-fearing people. But they were also kind. They took in abandoned or orphaned children, including my grandmother, Jewel. They cared for at least half a dozen kids over the years. For a time, they lived off the crops they raised on those 77 acres. Then, Will died, and Barbara divided the land between children and family friends. She died in 1964. I searched high and low trying to uncover exactly how Will and Barbara originally came into the land. I went through public records. I made phone calls to family members across multiple states. I called county officials. What experts and historians do know is that Black farmers were often gifted land from a white landowner, or possibly even a former slave master. My family records only date to the time when the Brodus split up their land.
Let me check one of my documents here, okay?
That's my cousin Plez. He has all of the records.
Jules Simmons, 2.52 acres. Mildred Sharp, 3.5 acres. Florida May Phillips, 2.5 acres. Catherine Young, 2.5 acres.
By the time the Brodus died, the children they raised had moved on and out of Gilmer. They wanted their children to go to college and work professional jobs, which usually took them to bigger cities, and that's exactly what happened. But while our family's commitment to the land declined, one thing did not: property taxes. They went up and up, and the land that should have been an asset became a liability.
I looked at it, it seemed like a headache.
My cousin Noel, who lives in Atlanta, sold the last of his family's parcel in 2009.
All I heard about the land was distress. My mother didn't concern herself with it for the most part, other than giving money to help pay property taxes.
There were other reasons not to hold on to the land. Yolanda Davis is another cousin and lives in Dallas. At one point, she considered using the Gilmer land as a retreat center for her youth mentoring group. So she went to Upshur County to deal with taxes. But when she got there, she says a white man overheard her talking about her plans.
And he said, "I don't want to deter you or any of that, but I don't think you being Black, this would be a good place for you all." And we're like, okay. He said, "I have some good Black friends, but there's a lot of white people out around here that's not really wanting Blacks to be in this area."
Yolanda sold most of her parcel in 2017.
"We would never live in Gilmer or even develop that land in Gilmer. We need to let that go."
Back to my dad's land. Remember when I was digging around my closet over a weekend during lockdown? Well, I had to catch my breath when I found an offer letter for my dad's land from a man I'd never heard of. Turns out, Dad agreed to sell his piece of land a long time ago. I had no idea he sold it, or why. The man who bought the land was named Shane Mahon. So I called him up to find out more.
Okay, so are you from like that vicinity, or are you from a different part of Texas?
I'm actually from Gilmer, originally.
Shane's 48, white, and has spent his entire life in Gilmer. He works as a home inspector. He's a deacon in a church, and he's been buying land in the area since he was 17. He estimates he's got around 60 or 70 acres now, including my dad's 2.5.
Yeah, I remember when we bought that property. We've been kind of like buying piece after piece and here and there. We were actually going to build a house on it if we got enough accumulated in there. Mm-hmm. But we never have. We've just got trees up there at the moment.
In the files I was searching through, I saw Shane offered my dad about $6,000 for the property. That figure felt really low to me. And then I saw paperwork in that same file cabinet showing the county had appraised the land at almost six times that amount. I asked Shane about that. He didn't agree the land is worth that much.
I was told that every acre in Upshur County is valued at $12,500, no matter what it is. And that's the base price. It can go up, but it won't go below $12,500 an acre. And they base every piece of land on that, no matter what.
Really? Huh.
And I couldn't disagree more. Because, like, Yolanda's half an acre, I'd be glad to send you a picture of it. It is a swamp. I mean, a swamp.
I reached out to the Upshur Appraisal Office. For the record, an official there said valuations vary, and not every property starts at $12,500 an acre. I've never been to Gilmer. I've never seen the land. The county said it was valued at more than $30,000, which would help explain why the taxes were so high. But when it came time to sell, it was only worth $6,000. That still didn't make sense to me. But when you start to add up the history of how we got the land, the multiple slivers that were parceled out to family owners who were impossible to track down, the inadequate record keeping, the nature of the land itself, and high taxes, you start to get a sense of how Black families in the U.S. have a hard time passing on wealth. Before I hung up, I asked Shane what he planned to do with the land.
Everything I do is to pass it on to my sons. To give them something, another foot to stand on when they get older.
Black Americans have been trying to shore up their economic futures for over 150 years. And we're going to spend a lot of time looking at how those efforts have been thwarted time and time again. But there are also places in the U.S. that are seen as havens for Black people. Places where ambitious young professionals are finding community and upward mobility. And there's one city that tops that list, Atlanta.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I've been a journalist at Bloomberg for 24 years. I started in Paris as a retail reporter. These days, I manage our bureaus across the Americas, among other things. And just over a year ago, one of our reporters, Jordan Holman, told me she wanted to leave New York City.
I pitched to you that I should be going to Atlanta, which I remember you were surprised about and said you did not expect that from me.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah, because you figured that I would want to stay in New York and that I was super happy there.
So why did you want to go to Atlanta?
I was imagining Atlanta just being super fun. You know, when I would bounce the idea off my friends, like, what if I moved to Atlanta? They were like, if I would move to any other city, it would be Atlanta because there's so much entertainment and culture here, lots of good food. And then the element that there's so many Black people there who are thriving. I was like, okay, I can make that work too. I can be part of that.
So you moved and now you're in Atlanta.
I am. And it's been really eye-opening. I think the idea of Atlanta as this Black Mecca had been so deeply ingrained in me growing up. I had cousins who graduated from Morehouse and Spelman, and when we visited, We went to the King Center and all of that. So I was really surprised when I read the stats. There are a lot of successful Black people in Atlanta, but the income inequality is also off the charts. The median household income for a Black family in Atlanta is about $28,000, compared to about $84,000 for a white family living in the city.
I was reading the biography of Maynard Jackson, the first African-American mayor. As you know, in Atlanta, he was elected in 1973, and in his biography, he talks about the need for affordable and workforce housing in Atlanta. So it's been fascinating to me that this is still a challenge for us.
That's Atlanta's current mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, speaking at a Clinton Foundation event in the fall. She's the city's sixth Black mayor, but she's talking about the first one, Maynard Jackson. He was elected in 1973 when he was just 35 years old. Atlanta was a center of Black political power during the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. grew up here, went to Morehouse, preached from Ebenezer Baptist. And by the end of the 1960s, you had a highly motivated, engaged Black community here. And they elected Jackson. I talked to Tiffany Bussey about this. She's the director of the Entrepreneurship Center at Morehouse. And she's been in Atlanta for 30 years.
I think we cannot have this conversation without really giving thanks and looking at the work and building on the shoulders of the work from Maynard Jackson, the first Black mayor of Atlanta.
He used his political power to lay the groundwork for what would become generations of Black wealth. And he did it with this very unsexy thing, government contracts. The city was expanding its airport to become an international hub. It was the largest construction project in the South at the time, and everyone wanted a piece. Jackson decided that a full 25% of the contracts were going to go to minority-owned firms. Prior to that, they got in just 1%.
By giving folks a chance and stating a certain percentage to let them in, not to lower the bar, not to change the quality of what needs to be done, but just saying we're going to give them an opportunity to get a piece of this pie, I think really, really cracked the door and started the whole movement.
The idea of giving minority groups preferential treatment for city contracts was new, controversial, and immediately effective. Within 5 years, about 39% of city contracts went to minority-owned firms, and other cities started to implement similar programs. But these set-asides, or affirmative action, was not universally popular. In Atlanta and elsewhere, they were almost immediately challenged in court, kicking off decades of legal battles that slowed everything down. By the time the airport gets done, Reagan's in the White House and the culture shifts. In Atlanta's growing Black middle class, kids are going to college to become lawyers or doctors or to work in consulting or head to Wall Street. And that's great. But what happens in Atlanta, and this is happening everywhere else in the U.S., is that money leaves the poor and working class Black neighborhoods and heads to the suburbs or neighborhoods with bigger houses, better schools, nicer supermarkets. Latresa McLawhorn Ryan is another longtime Atlanta resident who's watched some of these trends unfold. She heads the Atlanta Wealth Building Initiative, which raises awareness about income inequality in the city.
When people do have greater options, or the greater options that began to develop as a result of the policies that were put into place in the 70s, over time they move to where those amenities are easier to harness.
It's not just about the amenities. It's also about community, who your neighbors are. Before I moved here, I didn't realize just how cliquey Atlanta could be. So where do you go to college? Where do you go to church? Are you in a sorority? On one hand, those kind of networks build a lot of social and political capital, but they also leave a lot of people out. Here's Professor Bussey again.
I'm afraid that some of what I see happening in Atlanta is exactly that. You have the group that is making it, and then they go off into their own little social clubs and repeat what the majority community has done, and we know that we did not like what they did. Well, we have some of that happening also, and we have to find a way to break that and not repeat the same mistakes that we saw there.
There's definitely a lot working for some Black folks in Atlanta. For example, the median income for Black families in the city grew about 20% from 2013 to 2018. That was faster than for white households. And it was a bigger jump than for Black families in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. In the last decade, the number of Black households in Atlanta making at least $200,000 a year is up by 145%. That rising tide hasn't lifted all boats, at least not enough to put a dent in Black poverty or the racial wealth gap in Atlanta. There's a new generation of activists and politicians who are ready to leverage the city's political power to change that. And they're acknowledging that the issues we're seeing today were never fully dealt with in the past. Here's Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms again.
My husband is a corporate executive. I am the mayor of Atlanta. I live in a neighborhood that has not recovered from the 2008 crisis. I still owe more on my home than its value. And my schools in my neighborhood rank pretty much at the bottom of all of our public schools. We can't address one or the other. We have to address it comprehensively.
So, Jordan, does Atlanta feel like a Black Mecca in the same way it did before you moved?
I think Atlanta is definitely still a Black Mecca, but I am just realizing that there's a lot of forces working against it. For example, Atlanta has this affordable housing crisis. There's this shrinking Black middle class. And it's just taking a lot of effort to make sure it lives up to its reputation of being a Black Mecca and making sure that every Black person can benefit from some of, you know, the great opportunities that this city affords.
Atlanta's story is complex and layered and doesn't give us all the answers. What it does tell us about the racial wealth gap in the U.S. is that even small political decisions can have big impacts. Next week on The Paycheck, we'll be going deep on just that, the political history of the racial wealth gap and how moments both big and small led to the inequalities we see today.
You needed to break up the plantations and distribute the land for two reasons. This was the only way that African Americans would avoid being economically dependent on their former owners. They wouldn't really then be free.
They did not, you know, accidentally leave out people of certain races. It did so explicitly, methodically.
Where the civil rights movement didn't succeed was in any significant way addressing economic inequality between Blacks and whites in the United States.
Thanks for listening to The Paycheck. If you like this show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was hosted by me, Rebecca Greenfield.
And me, Jackie Simmons. This episode was edited by Janet Paskin and reported with the help of Jordan Holman, Brett Pulley, Maria Eloisa Capuro, and Katarina Sariva.
Our producers are Lindsay Cradwell, Magnus Henriksen, and Ethan Brooks. Our original music is by Leo Sidran. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. We'll see you next time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.